Hello again, and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is Carrie Weber, managing editor of America Magazine. Today we're speaking with Chris Lowney, who chairs the board of Catholic Health Initiatives, one of the nation's largest healthcare systems. He previously served as a managing director at J.P. Morgan and is a former Jesuit seminarian. He speaks widely on leadership, corporate ethics, and decision-making, and is the author of 4 books. He recently stopped by America House to discuss his newest book, Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads, which considers the lessons learned from the first Jesuit pope. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
My great pleasure.
I wonder if we could start with your telling us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the topic of leadership and Jesuit ideals and why you decided to sort of apply those to this topic.
The short version of my story is I grew up in New York in Queens, went to a Jesuit high school, joined the Jesuits right after that, and that was 1976. And I was a Jesuit for about half a dozen years. Last thing I was doing was teaching economics in a high school. And that's when I realized that my path, my best path as a Christian was not as a priest, but as a layperson. I ended up being lucky enough to get a job at J.P. Morgan and then was lucky enough to serve as a managing director there in Asia and Europe and New York. And I left Morgan in about 2000. And, you know, I guess my history explains a little bit the answer to your question, how to get interested in leadership and the Jesuit angle. I get a cheaper way to figure out my own life than going into therapy. And, you know, I guess the two sentence more I might say is that, you know, you work in one of these big companies nowadays, and about every month somebody gives you some book about management or leadership or something. And it's a critically important topic, but a lot of the books are total nonsense. You know, they're very shallow. And it sometimes used to strike me that the formation we got in the seminary somehow was more useful and relevant than some of the nonsense in these books. So the first book I wrote, my idea was to try to translate into a kind of a humanistic language, if you will, values or ideas that for Jesuits or for Christians, for Catholics, would have very deep religious roots.
And so with this book, Pope Francis, Why He Leads the Way He Leads, you chose to focus in particular on the leadership of the first Jesuit pope. Now, usually when we're looking at leadership of public figure like this, it's after the fact. It's maybe after they've died or after they're out of power. Why did you feel you were going to be able to speak confidently and accurately about this topic so early in the papacy?
Okay, well, I'd never make a claim that I could speak confidently or accurately about anything. But so how did the book come about? Well, as more or less as soon as he was elected, the publisher of Heroic Leadership asked if I'd be interested in writing something about the Pope. And I had, you know, I don't really feel I have any particular skills to write a biography. And in fact, there's already been a gusher of, I think, about 7, 8, 9 biographies. What I did think, though, is that it might be interesting to write about the Pope as a kind of a leadership case study. And you ask about the idea of writing something about his leadership before he really has established a track record. And I guess in a way, you know, one of the points I wanted to try to emphasize in the book, and something that in general is important to me when I speak to groups about leadership, is that, you know, we tend to have this unspoken but implicit idea that when you become a leader, then you start to think about, okay, well, what is my leadership style and principles, and what should I stand for? What might be my values as a leader? And for me, you know, it's game over at that point. And really, the way you lead reflects how you formed yourself and who you are. And that's the point that the book really tries to get at, you know, that this Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francis, that what he's doing now very much relates to who he has always been and how he formed himself and how he was formed. So that's really what the book is about, in a way, how leaders can form themselves, whether they're going to end up leading families or organizations or big companies or a whole church, how leaders can form themselves. And what are some of the, you know, habits leaders should cultivate? What are some of the commitments they should stand for? These kinds of things.
And so in your research and your reporting, you talked to a lot of people who had known Pope Francis as Jorge Mario Bergoglio. What are some of the stories that you found were really part of that formation that you're talking about?
So you're right. I was lucky enough to communicate with a number of Jesuits who had been seminarians in a big seminary where he was the boss, rector in Jesuit speak, right? And, you know, I was quite interested in what was the guy like then, because another, you know, big problem to me with leadership works and so on is that sometimes the way people conceive of leadership is it's like an act. You know, somebody becomes famous or important and then they try to present themselves a certain way. And really, I think you see somebody's leadership characteristics much more clearly before they're on stage and before the cameras start rolling. So I thought it'd be much more interesting to look at him when he was in that role, not on stage, and see what he stood for and what was he about. And a number of Jesuits were good enough to communicate with me. And I guess I'd say two things, you know, one, a story, but before a story, maybe an observation. So one of these guys said to me, you know, Chris, what I'm seeing now, I saw then. And what I'm hearing now, I heard then. And to me, that's very compelling in a leader, you know, and or maybe even to expand on it, it gets at some of the real nuance or complexity of being a leader. Because on the one hand, whatever environment you're in, whether it's a school, a hospital, a big company, a church, the world is changing at a very volatile place. It's very complex. And if you can't change, you can't lead well. But on the other hand, if everything is up for grabs, you can't lead well either. You know, so this idea that, you know, what I'm seeing now, I saw then, you know, I think is very compelling. In other words, there's a core, there's something that's solid, not everything is up for grabs. So that was one thing that one of them said to me that really struck me. You ask about stories, you know, there are various stories that struck me. One was that when I asked these folks, you know, what about this guy's leadership style? What made him noteworthy? What was him, you know, what do you remember about him as a leader? The first thing that a couple of them said to me, conveyed to me, was nothing to do with any great homily or speech or policy or anything else, but they remembered him doing the laundry for the community at 5:30 in the morning. And in some ways, that's quite a curious anecdote to associate with leadership. You know, like if I asked you about leadership, why would you say that? But on the other hand, I think there's a level at which that's totally understandable to any of us who've been managed or had to manage large groups of people. You know, namely that, you know, one of the things you find in organizations nowadays is that people tend to be very cynical about the people in charge. You know, that those in charge really care only about themselves, and what it's really all about is what's in it for me and how do I get ahead and the perks of my existence and so on. And I think leaders in all walks of life have to do exactly the opposite. You know, in other words, they have to somehow convey, no, look, this isn't about me. It's about something bigger than me and something bigger than us. And you who are on the team, you're valuable. And I have to find ways to make that clear. And for these guys, that image of him doing the laundry, I think was a kind of a code for what they took away. You know, namely, he asked us to make sacrifices, but he sacrificed first. And he found a way of conveying to us that we were valuable and important and so on.
It's interesting because it's in some ways it's a contrast to a quality that I think the secular world often associates with a leader, which is sort of that power or ambition, that desire to rise to the top, which is not necessarily something you want in a pope. So it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition of those two qualities. What do you think the role of ambition is in the papacy?
That's an interesting question. You know, let me start by picking up on your premise, the first point. I mean, you're right that nowadays, in almost all organizations, you know, the way people are by and large enculturated is to try to get themselves ahead. And I personally think that part of the reason why this guy, Pope Francis, I say it very colloquially, said this guy, is so compelling is precisely because he seems to represent the antithesis of all that. I mean, here's somebody who so obviously was not about getting ahead, and everybody kind of by now knows these stories that purportedly he was the runner-up in the last conclave, and any one of us could have told him what to do when you finish number two. You know, you start to cultivate your network and get yourself ahead and get high-profile jobs and so on. And instead, you know, he kind of went back to Buenos Aires and hung out with poor people who don't get to vote for Pope. So here's somebody who clearly seems to construe what he's doing in terms of mission and service and not in terms of personal ambition. So now the question you ask is what would be the role of ambition in for a pope and so on? And you know, I guess my personal take on that would be paradoxically no different than the role of ambition for a leader at JP Morgan where I made my career, which is to say this, that one of the things we understand about organizations, even though it's very hard to get this in reality, one of the things we understand is that the leaders who seem to perform best are leaders who are willing and able to put the mission, the objective, the cause ahead of their own ego, but at the same time, who really have a lot of drive and ambition. But that drive and ambition, that will, is dedicated not to me, but to the mission itself, okay? And to me, that would be the template you'd want in a pope also. In other words, I really have absolutely zero interest in somebody who has schemed for their whole clerical career to kind of catapult themselves ahead toward the papacy. I mean, that's the absolute last thing we need. So we don't want people whose ambition is to become pope. But then on the other hand, once someone is pope, we need, as you need in any job that's difficult, complex, where there's a lot of change and decisions to be made, people need to bring real drive and real will and real ambition, or else nothing happens, you know? So what we need and want is for the ambition to be channeled toward the mission, you know, in this sense, building the kingdom of God or furthering the church's mission, or however somebody might construe that broader sense of mission.
Now, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the ways in which Pope Francis's Jesuit identity and Jesuit formation in particular has sort of formed who he is as a leader.
So in the book, I tried to relate some of the things we're seeing now to how he was formed as a Jesuit. And I talk about six different commitments that to me, you know, one could trace to his Jesuit background. For example, the importance he places on really knowing yourself in a very deep way. And that to those who know Jesuit spirituality would be very familiar from the pieces of the spiritual exercises, from the practice of recollecting yourself daily, doing some kind of an examen or something. But the quality I might rather tend to focus on a little bit right now is what I call a frontier spirit. That isn't the way, although the Pope occasionally has used the word frontier, but generally that's not the way he speaks about. But to me, that's a deeply Jesuit thing, very needed in the church right now, and comes through very obviously in the way he operates. So, you know, first the Jesuit piece of it, as folks would know, when Jesuits were founded, they quite quickly became very much a missionary order. You know, some of the first European visitors to parts of Asia, India, Far East, Latin America were, in fact, Jesuits, you know. And the Pope himself wanted to be a missionary in that traditional sense. He wanted to go to Japan, and his superiors, in fact, the general of the Jesuits, didn't really accept his request to be a missionary because he had had a bad pulmonary infection or something when he was young, and they thought his constitution might be too weak. He's kind of proving that wrong a little bit in retrospect. But in any case, so that was kind of ingrained in his thinking. And if you look at what he says now, there's probably not a week that goes by when he doesn't, you know, use language like marginalized, missionary, frontier, journey, pilgrim. These ideas come back again and again and again. And in fact, just very recently, he, you know, authored his first big, long apostolic exhortation. It's all about missionary spirit. And the point I would make is that in the 16th, 17th century, we might have understood missionary in a geographical sense. You know, going to the frontiers meant literally there were parts of the earth that were not known to Europeans. Of course, they're very civilized people living there, but Europeans didn't know them. So the context of frontier would have been geographic. Now, of course, there is no frontier on earth. You know, we've more or less, everybody has traveled everywhere and everybody's on Facebook. So now the frontier is not 6,000 miles away from where you live. The frontier is around the block. We're here in New York City. You know, you're a serious religious believer in New York City, especially if you're a young adult. You might as well be a Martian. I mean, people just do not want to know. And so for the church to kind of find a way to how do we talk to people who are fed up and alienated, who've left the church behind, they don't care, they're atheist, they're drug addicts or marginalized, and nobody wants to be bothered dealing with them. You know, that to me are the frontiers that this Pope is really encouraging us to go after. And that is something that I think, you know, you see his Jesuit culture and Jesuit history coming through there a lot.
In what ways do you think Pope Francis's leadership has been really surprising? It's interesting to sort of look at this formation and to look at that Jesuit formation and to project what that would be, but you can't always predict it exactly. So what ways has it still surprised you?
You know, I think this Pope has managed to surprise everybody, like starting with hour one, you know, like this guy who showed up in the balcony and asked people to pray for his blessing before blessing them and spoke to people informally, you know, said good evening and took the bus instead of the limo, you know, all these kinds of things. I guess for me personally, among the things that have been, you know, when I say surprising, I don't mean the sense shocking, but things like that you might not, nobody really predicted or expected. You know, one would be to me his very plain spoken way of operating. You know, he's kind of pioneering, in a sense, a different way of communicating as a pope, and that's really proven highly effective. And, you know, one of the things that to me is kind of curious and interesting is that we, of course, tend to associate Jesuits often with academia and higher education and so on. But this pope is really championing exactly the opposite. You know, the way he speaks, the way he writes is extremely plain-spoken and down-to-earth. And in fact, in this apostolic or exhortation he just came out with, you know, he has notes on preaching that's in the thing, which is quite unusual that something so day-to-day would find its way into a big papal document. And one of the things he says is, look, you have to speak in a language that people understand. You know, you're not there to impress people by how smart you are. So that, you know, his plain-spokenness, that to me is one interesting surprise. And I guess another one that's kind of surprising me is how clear and insistent a sense of what kind of church he wants has been there from the very beginning. In other words, here's a guy who, you know, did not put together a platform to run for pope, but from the very beginning, the very same ideas have been coming up over and over and over again. And as far as I personally am concerned, I would say he's trying to ignite a massive culture change in the church. He wouldn't use those words, but I think that's what he's about. And that culture change includes, you know, to me, as I see it, ideas like we need to be way more identified with the poor than we are. Church is one of the biggest charitable organizations in the world, but still, we need to be way more identified in the poor. We must be much more simple in our own lifestyles, starting with the hierarchy, but that goes for all of us. We live in a very consumer society. I think in a way he's saying, okay, you know, we're supposed to stand for something different. We have to show that. To be much more outgoing and in outreach as Christians, and I think that's something that's very uncomfortable for Catholics culturally. In other words, well, let me give you an example. I've been a Catholic all my life. I go to church probably on average more than once a week. I've never been invited or told to invite somebody to come to church. That's something we just don't do. And I think he's saying, okay, my friend, it's time for everybody to get in the game. And that involves, you know, speaking about our beliefs. So, you know, I don't say surprise in the sense of these things are out of character or odd or I never would have imagined, but I say surprise in the sense of how clearly articulated a package he seems to have articulated right from the start.
The apostolic exhortation that you mentioned also talks, as you mentioned a little bit, about the poor and the economy. And obviously, as you know, the economy in the U.S. has gone through quite a bit of ups and downs recently. In some ways, some of the financial institutions have sort of undergone a crisis of leadership. Which Jesuit leadership elements would you say are most needed in the financial world today?
That's a really big, complicated question. And I don't know that I have an easy, ready-made answer for that. I don't know. I mean, I guess I would say this, and maybe it'll sound like a bit circling around to a principle that I mentioned before, that a big idea in Jesuit spirituality is this concept of magis, you know, and anybody who's been to a Jesuit school has heard that, and anybody who's been by a Jesuit building has seen AMDG chiseled into the wall, and so it stands for Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam. In other words, we're here to not to serve our own greater glory, but God's greater glory, okay? So keeping the sense of greater purpose in mind is really hard to do always, no matter what you do for a living. And it's really hard to do when you get into a world like investment banking, where there's so much money at stake and so much status to be gained, and the pace is so quick. You know, you really make it very quickly or you don't make it very quickly. And increasingly, a lot of financial services has become transactional. In other words, trading, as opposed to just serving companies and helping them to do what they want. And I would be very happy to defend the social good that big finance companies provide in the economy. And even though they took a real broadside from them, from the Pope, not only in what he wrote, but over the months. But this point that he is calling people, whatever you do for a living, to be willing to always have in front of yourself, look, are you ultimately serving the common good here, or is this all about yourself? That idea. And I think that would be a real useful idea for people in any organization to hold in front of them always, you know, whether you're in a school, a hospital, America Magazine, but certainly in, you know, in a big financial institution like JP Morgan, where often people come there for precisely the opposite reason. In other words, they come there to get rich. You know, it's sort of about me. And when you get places that are all about people, where it's all about me and how much I can stand, then things can really go wrong in a hurry, as we saw in the last few years.
In your own experience in the financial world, how did you sort of strike that balance?
So I wouldn't pretend that I struck that balance well or better than anyone else. In fact, I mean, there's a little bit of a tangent to your story, but you know, I worked at Morgan between 1983 and 2000, which was a time when that industry was changing a lot. And I have to tell you, you know, people who have not worked in that industry and who get their perceptions from reading the papers would find this hard to believe. But I have to tell you, you know, I worked for the most part with incredibly principled people, very principled people, who had lots of opportunities almost daily to do the wrong thing and did the right thing. And I would also tell you that I had the occasion to reflect more than once that, you know, when there might be a group of us managing directors trying to hash through some very complicated issue, whether, I don't know what, a possible transaction or a downsizing or whatever it might be, where there were ethical issues at stake, I was almost invariably ethically the best educated person in the room. In other words, I had majored in philosophy and I'd been in a seminary, so whereas most of these people had been in business school. But I had to confront the fact that rarely could I have called myself the most morally courageous person in the room. And I think that says, for me, that's a really interesting conundrum and mystery, you know, in terms of what makes people morally courageous. And unfortunately, I'm here to say it's not just about what people learn, you know, that makes them morally courageous.
Right, of course.
So I don't know. That was kind of a meandering answer to your question about what aspects of my background helped me maybe to now directly answer your question a little bit. I guess I would say, you know, I hope I picked up some good habits in my formation. You know, certainly, you know, one would be the idea of trying to step back daily from the maelstrom. You know, you work in any modern industry, but certainly areas like finance, technology, so on. And those are incredibly chaotic environments, you know, where your life is constant distraction and text and meeting and phone call. And, you know, this great Jesuit wisdom, or the wisdom of St. Ignatius, that every day you need to take little mental pit stops, he wouldn't have called them that, to reflect a bit on why you're grateful as a human being and your sense of purpose as a human being and what you're doing well and poorly and how God maybe is present in your life. That 16th century methodology he came up with is really incredibly relevant, way more relevant, I think, in the 21st century. So, you know, I would hope that I picked up a couple of good habits like that served me in good stead on Wall Street. But, you know, whether I did a good job or not, I shouldn't be the one to say. People who worked with me and for me would be the ones to make that kind of judgment.
Sure. Well, you bring up an interesting point of a good leader being conscious of those people around you, and that includes other leaders and the sort of the people. It's not just you caring about the subordinates that you're working with or caring about what your boss might think, but the people that are in the room with you, and also being cautious not to write off a group of people. Like you're saying, sometimes people who might read about a certain group of CEOs somewhere might think, oh, all of them are this way or all of them are that way. And I think good leaders are open to the idea that you can't put a label on an entire group of people like that.
I guess I'd say a couple of things. I mean, one is, you know, I think the Pope has told us a lot here about being careful to make anticipatory judgments of people and so on. And I think that applies. You know, we kind of form judgments of people who are different than us and doing different things than us. And, you know, invariably, when you're a Democrat, the Republican politician is a real crook. And, you know, when you work in social work, the people on Wall Street are crooks and, you know, and so on and so on. So, you know, kind of trying to understand who people are, I think, is always relevant. But also you make this good point of when you're in a position of leadership authority to also be aware of the whole group and what others bring and so on. And that, you know, so when I started working at Morgan, when we used a word like leader or leadership, we would have thought of the CEO of JP Morgan. But then in the course of the 80s and 90s, when the world got so much more complex, we kind of understood that, you know, there's no way in the world that one person or a small group of people make all the relevant decisions. And so we really understood that you need a very widely distributed idea of leadership. That basically means everybody has a leadership opportunity. And when I, you know, speak to groups or corporate groups, I always go to one of the dictionary definitions of leadership that, you know, it's to point out a way and to influence others toward a goal or direction. And I mean, everybody does that. Could there be any more obvious example of pointing a way and influencing others than what parents do for their children, you know? So one of the first things I point out is, okay, look, you're in a family, you're sitting in a corner cubicle, you don't think you're important. Whatever is your situation, you need to accept the fact that you have an opportunity and responsibility to lead right then. You know, you may not be in charge of the strategy or the budget, you may not be running the place, but you have some opportunity to have influence and to role model a way, and, you know, you need to take that on to yourself.
Right, like the little way of Saint Therese, I guess, combined with this bigger way of Pope Francis.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, you know, you mentioned little Saint Therese, I think, is a good example of that. And yes, you know, the book about too many of these leadership books are like, let's look at Dwight Eisenhower or Barack Obama or Pope Francis or Nelson Mandela, and let's look at why they are great. And I very purposefully, you know, I'm not interested in that kind of thing. So I was interested in using the Pope as a case study, but really the all of the lessons in the book are supposed to be universally relevant. In other words, it's not about here's Pope Francis' leadership style and let's admire him. It's okay, here's Pope Francis' leadership style and here are the implications for you. So what about you? Or what about me?
Very good. Well, thank you so much. That was really helpful. I appreciate your stopping by.
My pleasure.